This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Louis Black is a stand-up comic and commentator on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, the nightly show of political satire on Comedy Central. Black's political and social commentaries always seem fueled by his anger and exasperation. The cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer has said, "Louis Black has to shout because he knows that no one who counts is listening. We, who do not count, depend on and are grateful for the common sense behind his comic rage. When power corrupts, Louis erupts." Now Black has a new memoir called Nothing Sacred and a new CD released by Comedy Central Records. Let's start with a commentary he gave on The Daily Show last month.
With our troops overextended, intelligence reform bogged down, gas prices at an all-time high, and millions of kids without health care. It was comforting last week to see Congress take on the most pressing issue of all. Do baseball players use steroids? Here's a hint. Yes! On Thursday, seven former and current big leaguers spoke before Congress in testimony far more riveting than an actual baseball game. The star attraction, 6'5", 220 pounds, able to bench press the mezzanine at Busch Stadium, Mark McGuire. He'll be staring down a tough opponent, the truth.
Well, sir, I'm not here to talk about the past.
Strike one!
Like I said earlier, I'm not going to go into the past and talk about my past.
Strike two!
I'm not here to talk about the past.
Strike three! No one came off worse than Big Mac. At one point, the strain of not answering anything even made him start crying. Crying? There's no crying in baseball testimony. Fortunately, Congressman Mark Sauder wasn't letting him off the hook.
If the Enron people come in here and say, well, we don't want to talk about the past, do you think Congress is going to let them get away with that?
A fascinating hypothetical. What would happen if the Enron guys got dragged before Congress?
I must respectfully decline to answer, on Fifth Amendment grounds, all the questions of this committee and subcommittee.
Will you invoke your Fifth Amendment rights in response to all questions here today?
Yes, I will. I respectfully decline to answer the question based on the protection afforded me under the Constitution of the United States.
Okay. But if the subject had been steroids, they really would have let him have it.
Louis Black, welcome to Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Can you talk about how this commentary was written, like what the genesis of it was?
Well, I'm going to burst a bubble here. I don't write the commentary, so I perform it. Essentially, for a long time, my segment was an island unto itself. And then John, once he had a vision of the show, began to bring me into the fold by giving us the kind of the topics he wanted us to do, and then we would. So that was already narrowed down. We would do the same sort of thing. I would write, kick it back. And then my career kind of took off, and I began to travel more. I wasn't there as much as I could be. And by the time, which now this is just about a year and a half, I guess now, 2 years maybe, the writers at the show were writing me, you know, they're writing a better me than I can.
So when the writers write a piece for you, do you have a chance to make any changes you want to?
Oh, yeah. I can throw stuff back to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, what happens is they write it and they send it to me. I look at it, but usually it goes immediately back to the staff there, the guys in charge. They look at it again. They rework it, and then they send it back to me, and then they rework it again. And when I get it, the last time that I get it, is usually when I'll throw some things in.
How would you describe your persona on stage?
Basically a very deeply frustrated individual who expresses his frustration through anger.
And does that describe you off stage too?
No, I don't have the energy for that. People always ask, are you like that all the time? And I said, if I was like that, I'd be dead.
How did you create this onstage persona of the deeply frustrated, angry guy?
It's always been a part of my personality, and I'd always kind of had that. I never really thought I'd become a comic. I thought I was going to be a playwright. And I was doing it on the side for fun, and I would kind of work on, you know, ways to approach it, and nothing was working. And then Dan Ballard, who's a very funny comedian who works out of Michigan, was watching me one night and came up and said, you know, the next time you go back on stage, he said, you know, you start yelling, okay? Because, listen, you're angry. I yell on stage, he said, all the time. I'm not angry, and I'm yelling, and I shouldn't be yelling, and you're angry, and you should be yelling. And that was it, and that really released it all.
Did you model any of your approach on your father or on older people in your family?
I think I modeled it a little bit on my mother and a bit from my grandfather, who was, wow, he was Mr. Angry.
And what would he get angry about, and how would he sound?
Everything.
Like he was angry?
I mean, you know, he was in a constant state of complaint, but he seemed to. He seemed to, like my mother, it's like I've said about my mother, as long as there's something, you know, as long as there's something to be angry about, she will live forever. And my grandfather pretty much had that going. I mean, he would just go, the Vietnam War, he goes, he was like, you know, he sat there in the living room, we're watching the 6 o'clock news, and he goes, you know, he said, if I knew it was going to be like this, I could have stayed in Russia. I go, you don't want to be there. I said, you're crazy. He says, no, this is... And he goes, no, this is crap. And he would bitch, and I would find it funny.
In your new book, you write a little bit about what you were like as a kid. And you say, for a time, I was a square squared. My mother dressed me in irregular clothing, and my pants were always way, way too baggy. When I asked why they were so big, my mother replied, because you have a big crotch. The top button of my shirt was always buttoned, and I wore big tortoiseshell glasses, so I looked like a dump truck in heat. So, were you a nerdy kid?
Yeah. I really, I hit that period of like 11, 12, which those years which are difficult and fragile at best, mm-hmm. I was pretty nerdy.
Did having big glasses, even when you were a kid, affect your social life?
Oh, yeah. You know, and especially since, as I look back at the pictures, I go, you know, was nobody fashion conscious? My uncle was an optometrist. And so I was going, what was he putting these glasses on my face for?
Now, you say that your parents weren't observant Jews, except for like the High Holy Days. But you went to a Yom Kippur service, which is the Day of Atonement for Jewish people. And it really shook you up. What happened?
Well, when I was really young, I'll never forget the first Yom Kippur service because... At first, they play a piece of music that is, I say, all the music that Alfred Hitchcock has in his films. The scary music is based on a thing called the Kol Nidre, where this organ kind of plays. For a kid, it was too spooky for words. It's supposed to, I believe, inspire awe, but when you're, you know, 5 to 8, it inspires panic. And you almost sense that there should be bats flying around, and and then the idea of it is that is the day in which God writes your name in the book of life or the book of death, and that was a concept, death, that had not crossed my table. No one in the family had died as of yet. I had never thought of it as something that was hooked up with God. That there was some sort of a power figure that I was supposed to make sure that I kept at bay because he might decide to kill me. And it really had a big effect on me. It scared the hell out of me.
So you started praying compulsively. What were your prayers like?
I did start praying compulsively. It began with, my idea was that if I had a, because what you do is when you get in there, you apologize for all the bad things you did during the year. And, you know, I was not respectful to my parents. I wasn't nice to my friends, all of this stuff. So whenever a thought or an action that I thought was a red line situation crossed my desk after this, I would immediately respond by having to say something to the effect of, I'm sorry, God. And that started slowly, and then it built up to, I had to say, 10 I'm sorry, Gods. And then it grew as thoughts kind of became a little worse, because I think what occurs when you get into that tape loop as a child is that it's an obsessive compulsive behavior. So the thoughts became worse, and then the prayers became so. Then I have to say, I'm sorry, God. And then after I said, I'm sorry, God, I had to thank him. So it was, I'm sorry, God, thank you, God. Then I began to add breaths in between. So it'd be, I'm sorry, God. I'd have to breathe in. Then I go, God, I breathe out. And then I'd have to breathe in, thank you, God, and then breathe out. I had, like, breath patterns, too, that I got. It was an elaborate system that I had developed that I'm glad isn't on film today.
So did the rabbi know about this?
Nobody knew about it. I never mentioned it to anybody. It was between me and my maker.
So how did you stop?
My grades started to fall. Because I've asked my parents. They don't remember. They never caught me doing it. My friends at school, because of the breathing patterns, there were kids sitting around me looking at me going, what is the matter with you? You know, because I'd stop in the middle of a test and go through this. And my parents took me to some sort of a counselor or psychiatrist at the University of Maryland. And I went once, and I knew I didn't really want to talk about it, so I'd better stop it. And I really did. It stopped me on a dime.
Well, Lewis Black, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, this was really a pleasure. I really had a good time.
Lewis Black has a new memoir called Nothing Sacred. Tomorrow we'll hear from Daily Show correspondent Stephen Colbert.